The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon. I am Horacio Grigera-Naon, the director of the Center for International Commercial Arbitration of the Washington College of Law. I'm very happy to see so many graduates from this law school and also students who are joining us to speak about arbitration and to hear about arbitration. And we have today a very distinguished panel of graduates from the Washington College of Law who, in their own right, have made a path for themselves in the area of international commercial arbitration. The purpose of this panel will be, in a certain way, not too organized. Why is it not too organized? Because the area of arbitration, of international commercial arbitration, is so rich and it has been developed in so many different orientations that sometimes it is difficult to put, to package everything into one single way of presenting issues and challenges. So I'm going to introduce the speakers. Immediately on my right-hand side, Céline Aimé Wattier, LLM from the Washington College of Law 2006. Céline is Deputy Counsel of the Secretariat of the ICC International Court of Arbitration based in Paris. She's working in the team dealing principally with Europe, Africa, and the Middle East. And guess what? In January 2012, new ICC arbitration rules came into effect, and Céline will be addressing that. Immediately on the right-hand side of Céline, I have the pleasure of introducing Eckhard Helbeck, LLM 1987, to you. He's a senior associate with White & Case LLP in Washington, D.C. And his practice turns around international dispute resolution with a special emphasis in complex arbitration and litigation proceedings based on international treaties and contracts. So he's going to speak about some interesting ways of using federal statutes in support of arbitration, even when the arbitration panel is not sitting in the USA. Immediately on the right-hand side, we have Marcos Orellana, LLM 1998, HID 2009. Marcos is a senior attorney and director of Ciel's Human Rights and Environmental Program. And prior to joining Ciel, he was a fellow to the Lauterpacht Research Center for International Law at the University of Cambridge. And Marcos really brings in a different aspect in connection with us business lawyers. He's going to speak about other issues and put them into a larger public international law perspective. And immediately on my right-hand side, Maria Rubert, LLM 2009. She specializes in dispute resolution, including state court litigation, arbitration, and mediation. She's admitted to practice in Spain and the state of New York. And she leads her firm's regional arbitration practice based in Dubai. So, as you can see, we have diversity coupled with expertise. And so, without further ado, I invite Céline to start with the works of this panel.
Thank you, Horacio. I'm very happy to be on this panel as a WCL alumni and former Dean's Fellow for the Arbitration Program. And actually being involved in this program and working with Horacio brought me to the world of arbitration. And so since we're talking about trends in international arbitration, I thought that I would talk to you about the new ICC rules of arbitration, which entered into force in January 2012. I was actually involved in those rules revision process. And so the previous version of the rules of arbitration entered into force in 1998, so quite a long time ago. So that's why the ICC decided to revise its rules to adapt them to the new complexities and challenges of the world of arbitration. So since I have limited time, I'm not going to enter into details, and I'm going to just address a couple of points and the main changes of the rules. Don't hesitate to interrupt if you have any questions. I love answering questions, so please don't hesitate. So first of all, the new rules of arbitration have introduced clearer time and costs provisions. So in the rules, you can see different obligations and provisions in this regard. First of all, the arbitral tribunal and the parties have an obligation to conduct the arbitration in a cost-effective manner and expeditious manner, which was also an obligation under the old rules, but now it's specifically provided in the new rules. And for this, you have, for example, in the new rules, a case management conference, which is mandatory. What it means is that when the arbitration starts, the arbitral tribunal has to hold a conference with the parties. It can be an in-person conference or a conference call, just to talk about the first aspects of the procedure and to set the procedural timetable, to sign the terms of reference. And then the arbitral tribunal can hold further case management conferences throughout the arbitral proceedings. And then a very important provision is that now, after the last hearing during the arbitral proceedings or after the final briefs are submitted, the arbitral tribunal has a duty to inform the parties and the ICC of the date when it intends to submit the award. So the award, which is the decision, since, as you may know, so the arbitral tribunal drafts the final decision, the final award, and the parties are always eager to receive the draft award as soon as possible. So that's why this provision is quite useful, because now the ICC and the parties know approximately when the draft award is going to be submitted. Now the arbitral tribunal can make cost orders in response to a party misconduct. So what it means is that, for instance, during the arbitral proceedings, the arbitral tribunal can make cost decisions and other than the costs of arbitration fixed by the court, and the arbitral tribunal can order that party to make the payment. So, for instance, if a party failed to pay the arbitration advance fixed by the court, so the money that it has to pay to the ICC. Now, for instance, the tribunal can make an order and decide that during the arbitral proceedings, that party has to pay its share of the budget fixed by the ICC. And then at the end of the case, the arbitral tribunal may take into account all relevant circumstances, including the extent to which each party has conducted the arbitration in an expeditious and cost-effective manner. So, for instance, if a party was very litigious during the whole proceedings, then the tribunal can take that into account to decide which party is going to bear the cost of arbitration. So all these provisions are to render the arbitral proceedings more efficient and more cost-effective in a cost-effective manner. Then one of the main changes of the rules is the way jurisdictional objections are being dealt with. So I'm not going to enter into much details for this, but just to explain, just to summarize, so when a party is a respondent, it can file what we call jurisdictional objections, because it objects to being a party to that arbitration, and it files a plea concerning the existence or validity of the arbitration agreement. So now the new procedure is that the jurisdictional objections filed by a respondent are going to be dealt with most of the time directly by the arbitrators, while in the previous rules, the Court of Arbitration needed first to take a decision on whether the arbitration could proceed. Now, so most of the time it's going to be dealt with directly by the tribunal, which will save time and cost for everyone, unless the Secretary General of the Court of Arbitration decides that the matter is complex, so complex that it shall be first referred to court. So it's most of the cases, it's when you have, for instance, an arbitration agreement which is not signed by the respondent party, or where there are multiple agreements and it's not clear that the party which objects to the jurisdiction could be a party to the arbitration. So this is a very important change. And there's also transparency in the court's decision when the court decides whether the arbitration shall proceed regarding the party which objects to the jurisdiction of the ICC. So the arbitration shall proceed if the court is prima facie satisfied that an arbitration may exist between the parties. So when we say prima facie, it means that the court takes a first decision, but it means that the arbitral tribunal will ultimately decide on its own jurisdiction. So for instance, when you have more than two parties, so usually you have one claimant, one respondent, but in many cases now we have maybe two claimants, three respondents, so that's when what we call multi-party cases, the court must be satisfied that an arbitration agreement exists and binds all of the parties. And you also have cases where a claimant files a case on different arbitration agreements. So in that case, the court must be satisfied that the different arbitration agreements are compatible, and that all parties may have agreed that the claims may be determined in one arbitration and not different arbitration. It can sound a little bit technical. I'm trying to be as concise as possible. Then another change is the way the arbitrators are appointed. Usually, so the court appoints arbitrators when a party fails to make an appointment, or when the parties ask the court to appoint, or where the co-arbitrators fail to appoint the chairman of the president of the arbitral tribunal. So what happens is that in most of the cases, the court has to ask what we call national committees, which are committees of the ICC in approximately many countries worldwide, and they ask the national committee to propose an arbitrator to be confirmed by the Court of Arbitration. But now the court has more flexibility to appoint directly arbitrators without asking a national committee to propose an arbitrator. And the court can do so, can appoint directly arbitrators where there's a party which is a state party or a state entity, or where there's no national committee in that country, or also where the court the court's president considers that it's that direct appointment is necessary and appropriate. So it means that it's going to be very useful in some of the cases where the court can directly appoint arbitrators. Now we now turn to complex arbitrations. So the new rules have introduced clear provisions concerning complex arbitrations. So what we call complex arbitrations are arbitration usually with multiple parties or multiple contracts. So for instance, let's first talk about the joinder issue. When we talk about joinder, it means that you have, for instance, a case with one claimant, two respondents, and then one of the respondents wants to join another party which was not a party to the first, to the arbitration proceedings. So now there's a new provision which allows a party to join an additional party, so a third party, to the arbitration. And to do so, the party needs to file what we call a request for joinder to the ICC, and then the ICC receives a request for joinder, notifies the request for joinder to the party in question, to the additional party, and at that time the additional party becomes automatically a party to the arbitration. Even though the additional party doesn't want to be joined, it becomes automatically a party to the arbitration. So you may think, well, it's a bit unfair for the additional party if it doesn't want to be a party to the arbitration. So if the additional party objects to being a party to the arbitration, it cannot object to the request for joinder, but it can object by filing jurisdictional objections, and then we go back to what I said before. Then it raises jurisdictional objections, and then under Article 6.4 of the rules, and then either the objections will be dealt with directly by the arbitrators, or the court has to decide whether the arbitration shall proceed. So just to summarize, just to clarify, no additional party may be joined to the arbitration proceedings after the confirmation or appointment of any arbitrators. So what it means is that when a party appoints an arbitrator, the arbitrator is not automatically an arbitrator in that case. The person has to be confirmed as arbitrator by the court. And so no additional party may be joined after the confirmation, because it would mean that the additional party couldn't have participated in the constitution of the arbitral tribunal, which would be very problematic. So that's why no additional party may be joined unless all the parties, including the additional party, agree to the constitution of the arbitral tribunal. Then the rules also provide now for the possibility of claims between multiple parties. What it means, pursuant to Article 8, what it means is that when, in the example that I gave earlier, if you have one claimant and two respondents, so usually most of the time we see respondents bringing counterclaims against claimant, but the respondents can also bring counter claims between each other. So respondent 2 can have claims against respondent 1. So you can have claims, all the parties can have claims against each other, which complicate the arbitration proceedings for sure. So this is clarified in the rules. And also the parties can the claimant can bring claims out of more than one contract into one arbitration. That's what we call multiple contracts. And so it can introduce a request for arbitration on the basis of two contracts. For instance, there's an option agreement and then a share purchase agreement, and the claimant has claims under both of the contract, so it can bring those claims, the two claims in one arbitration, provided that that there's no jurisdiction objection, and if there are, as I said earlier, then the court will examine whether prima facie it can be satisfied that an arbitration agreement exists, and there's the jurisdictional control of the court test with Article 6.4.2. And then another provision of the rules concerning complex arbitrations concern the consolidation of cases, which is clarified in the new rules. So what it means is that when you have two pending arbitrations, the court may consolidate the two arbitration proceedings into one arbitration. So for instance, if you have A company A which files a request against B, and then at the same time company B files a request against B and C, A and C, for instance, you have two arbitration pending, and so the court may consolidate those two cases in several situations. First of all, if the parties agree, then there's no problem, the court can consolidate situation A, or if the parties fail to agree, then the court has to take a decision on the consolidation. And if all the claims are made in the two arbitration, if they remain under the same arbitration agreement, and it can also consolidate. And if there are more than one arbitration agreement, the two arbitrations or more have to be between the same parties. The dispute have to rise in connection with the same legal relationship, and the arbitration agreements have to be compatible. So this test is very clear in the rules. And then the court may take into account other circumstances to decide whether it can consolidate arbitrations. Then now I'm going to briefly address the topic of investment treaty arbitration. So when revising the rules, the Commission Working Group on States and State Entities made some recommendations to the ICC for the rules revision, because originally the ICC tradition is concerned international commercial arbitration, but the ICC wanted to have more investment cases, investment treaty-based arbitration. So there are several examples in the rules which show that the ICC want to have more investment treaty arbitration. So for instance, the 1998 rules refer to business disputes, while now the rules only refer to disputes, which means that more disputes can be arbitrable under the ICC rules, and for instance, investment arbitration. And now the court can also, as I told you, directly appoint arbitrator where there is a state party. So you might wonder, why is it relevant? When a state is a party, the state is usually reluctant to having an arbitrator proposed by a national committee of its own country, and so that's why it doesn't really like this procedure, and that's why when a state is a party, the court can directly appoint an arbitrator without resorting to the process of going through the national committee procedure. And also, when an arbitrator acts in a case, it has to be, of course, independent, and this obligation has always been in the rules, but now not independent from the parties, but now the arbitrators also have to be impartial and this was the Commission Working Group on States and State Entities was very strong about it and wanted the word impartiality to be added to the obligation of the arbitrators. So now, last but not least, the new rules have introduced a new procedure, which is called the emergency arbitrator procedure. So this new procedure was created for urgent interim and conservatory measures that cannot wait the constitution of the arbitral tribunal. So what it means is that before a request for arbitration is filed, a party can file an application for emergency measures to the ICC and ask the ICC to appoint an emergency arbitrator who's going to be a different arbitrator than the arbitral tribunal, which is going to be later constituted and which is going to decide on the merits of the case. So it only has a limited jurisdiction to decide only on the emergency measures. And just to be clear, the emergency arbitrator provisions shall not apply if the arbitration agreement was concluded before the entering into force of the new rules, so January 2012. So that's why we're talking about future cases, and we still haven't had a case with an application for emergency measures under this procedure, because it's recent and it's only concerns the new arbitration agreements. Also, it will not apply if the parties specified in their contract that the emergency arbitrator provisions shall not apply, or if the parties have agreed to another pre-arbitral procedure. So what happens is that the party files the application. The ICC receives the application. The ICC received the application, and the court's president decides whether to accept the application. So there has to be, the arbitration agreement has to be clear, and it has to be signed by both parties. And then the ICC notifies the application to the other party, to respondent, and then the ICC appoints the emergency arbitrator, usually within 2 days. So all this has to be very fast. And so then we transfer the file to the emergency arbitrator, who's going to have to invite the other party to comment, but within a very limited period of time. And at that very important requirement is that the 10 days after the filing of the application for emergency measures, the request for arbitration has to be filed by the claimant. So it needs to be done in parallel. So if a request for arbitration has not been filed, then the application will not proceed, and it will be the emergency arbitrator will not render an order. So once the emergency arbitrator has made its decision, it renders an award. So usually it has to be done within 15 days of the file being transmitted to the emergency arbitrator. So as I told you, it's only for emergency measures, and the arbitrator is going to be different from the arbitrator who's going to decide on the merits of the case. And the parties undertake to comply with the order, but the only difference is that the order is not going to be an award, so it's not going to be enforceable as an award. So it's only enforceable, I mean, the parties need to comply with it, but if the parties don't comply with it, you cannot really do anything about it. But it's going to be an incentive for the respondent to comply with the order, because if the arbitration then goes forward after with the other arbitral tribunal, then it should comply with the order. And these provisions only apply to parties which are either signatories to the arbitration agreement or successors to such signatories. And the order which was rendered by the emergency arbitrator will not bind the arbitral tribunal later constituted, because the arbitral tribunal may modify, terminate, or annul the order. So yes, so that's it. So it was I tried to be very concise. I hope you understood the main points. Thank you very much.
We can take questions now.
Yes, if you have questions, please. The average what? Sorry? There's no average. There's a general provision in the rules which say that the award shall be rendered within 6 months of the signature of the terms of reference. The terms of reference is the document signed by the arbitral tribunal and the parties concerning what the arbitral tribunal will have to decide. So it should be 6 months, but this is a theoretical time limit, because this time limit can be extended by the Court of Arbitration. So you can have simple arbitration where an award can be rendered within maybe 8 months, and then other very complex arbitrations where the procedural timetable provides for exchange of briefs and hearings which are going to last more than 2 or 3 years. So obviously it's going to be very long. So it really, that's why the case management conference at the beginning of the arbitration is very important, because there's going to be a discussion between the parties and the arbitral tribunal, and they're going to decide on the dates of the calendar, and on that basis then at the ICC we can determine how long approximately it should last. But I've had a few cases which lasted 10 years, but it was an exception. Yes? Yes? The court can extend the time limit. The court can extend the time limit, but because the time limit of 6 months is provided by the rules, but the rules also provide that the court can extend the time limit for the arbitral tribunal. The court extends the time limit on the basis of what is going on in the case. I mean, if the court sees that there are still going to be two hearings of experts, pleadings hearings, maybe for 6 months, then the court knows that it has to extend the time limit. But then if it sees that the case is almost done and the parties have filed their post-hearing briefs, and then the court sees that the arbitral tribunal still has not rendered the award, then it will put pressure on the arbitrator to render the award as soon as possible. So it's really on a case-by-case basis.
That means that the court doesn't need to say some kind of agreement with the parties.
No, because if they have agreed to ICC arbitration, they have agreed to all the provisions which are in the rules, and there's a provision which says that the court can extend the time limit. Unless there's a specific provision in the arbitration agreement which provides that the arbitral tribunal shall render the award within 8 months from the terms of reference. But if it's not included in the arbitration agreement, then the rules apply. Mm-hmm. Yes. It's an agreement, and then the court does everything possible to respect that agreement. But there's also a provision which says that even when the parties have specified a specific time limit, the court can extend. I mean, the court then extends the time limit not to go against the party's will. It's just to be sure that the award will always be rendered within the time limit provided by the rules. So a time limit cannot expire, because if the time limit expires, it means that the arbitrator's mission and the arbitrator's role does not exist anymore. So, but that's why the ICC's role is very important, to make sure that everything goes well. Thank you. Sorry, it's just that it doesn't work here, but
just put it on to him.
No, I think that you had to use that one.
We're good now.
Well, you used the one that works.
All right. Well, good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for attending this session. I'm very proud to be back here as a graduate of the program, and to be part of an all-graduate panel here, which is quite amazing in this field of international arbitration, which certainly, when I was an LLM student here, was not sort of its own field of study at all. It was one course that dealt in part with international arbitration. It was a course on international disputes resolution, which also dealt in large part with international litigation, meaning litigation in U.S. courts involving foreign parties or foreign subject matters. And that actually brings me right to the subject matter of what I would like to talk to you about today, which is the use of U.S. discovery, meaning discovery in the U.S., in aid of arbitrations going on outside of the U.S., international arbitrations outside of the U.S. And there is a provision in the U.S. Federal Judicial Code, it's section 1782, which is not that well known, but every now and then comes up, and there's quite some uncertainty about its applicability and scope, and I just thought I'd highlight some of these issues because they are of tremendous practical relevance in certain scenarios. For example, if you conduct an arbitration outside of the U.S. between foreign parties, but perhaps one of the, say you're representing the claimant and the respondent has a subsidiary or a parent corporation in the U.S., and that U.S. Company actually holds all sorts of documents that you would like to see because you think that they will help you prove your case. In that case, you certainly have the option of requesting the respondent within the arbitration to produce those documents. And then the respondent may say, well, I don't have them. I don't have control over them. I can't produce them. And very often that'll be the end of the story, because if the arbitration is cited abroad, then the local court to which one could go would also have trouble asserting jurisdiction over the U.S. Parent corporation, let's say, that actually holds the documents. Now, in this scenario, there is a possibility of making use of Section 1782, but I must add, perhaps, because, as we will see, there's a lot of uncertainty there as to whether 1782 actually applies to international arbitration, and if so, whether an application under Section 72 actually will be granted. We'll get to that. But first, let's look quickly at the text, the language of 1782. It says, the district court of the district in which a person resides or is found may order him, meaning the person, to give his testimony or statement or to produce a document or other thing for use in a proceeding in a foreign or international tribunal. Then it goes on, the order may be made pursuant the application of any interested person that is of interest, as we shall see. And then further down it says that absent any other agreement or rule, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure apply to the discovery, meaning you're dealing with U.S. discovery. It's not some foreign procedure. So moving right along, the threshold requirements, meaning when does 1782 apply at all, those requirements are listed here. There are three of them. One is, of course, that the target from whom you're seeking discovery must reside in the U.S. and must reside in the judicial district of the court to which the application is being made. And this is always a federal court because we're dealing with a federal statute here. And then the request must be made by either a foreign or international tribunal or by an interested person. And an interested person could be a party to the foreign arbitration. That's pretty clear. There's not much doubt about that. The doubts arise when it's a non-party to the arbitration that asserts an interest, and that may be an issue. Now, the evidence that is being sought from the target must be intended for use in the proceeding before the foreign or international tribunal, so not for any other purpose. Now, the Supreme Court has, in addition, developed four discretionary factors. They come into play once the threshold factors have been met. So you've met the threshold requirements, but then the court still is not obligated to grant the discovery request. It has discretion. And in exercising that discretion, it looks to these four factors. One is whether the target is actually a party to the arbitration or not. What this means is that if the target is a party to the arbitration, the court will be less inclined to grant discovery because in that case the applicant can use the arbitral process and ask the arbitral tribunal to order the other party to produce the evidence. The second factor is the nature of the foreign tribunal, the character of its proceeding, and its receptivity to U.S. federal judicial assistance. Now here, the factor that is being looked at is about whether the U.S. court becoming active in the evidence-gathering process would in any way interfere with the foreign arbitral proceeding to the point where it would run counter to the nature of the proceeding, its character, or where perhaps the foreign tribunal has already stated that it does not wish to receive evidence gathered in the U.S. pursuant to this proceeding. Or, for example, if the period for submission of evidence in the proceeding is already over, and or the proceeding is closed, and these kind of things. And then the third element is whether or not the application is a concealed attempt to circumvent any foreign restrictions or policies in other countries. It's not 100% clear exactly what that means, but it certainly would apply to scenarios where the gathering of this kind of evidence were prohibited by a foreign statute or by a court order or something. Then the fourth discretionary factor is the burden on the target. So if you know you're asking for a truckload of documents just to find one little piece of paper, you know, the court might say, well, that's overly burdensome, and then limit and restrict the discovery to certain things. And the I've got the site there on the screen. It's the Intel case in which the Supreme Court developed these discretionary factors. We'll get back to that case in a moment. The biggest issue, I think, in the context of international arbitration is whether or not 1782 actually applies to international arbitration. And that all hinges upon the element of a foreign or international tribunal, meaning the international arbitral tribunal at issue has to be a foreign or international tribunal within the meaning of Section 1782. Now, looking at those four words, foreign or international tribunal, one would normally conclude, why not? It's a foreign arbitration, it's an international arbitration, an arbitral tribunal is a tribunal, so what's the problem? Well, the problem is one of history and one of interpretation. The historical aspect is that Congress actually amended 1782 in 1964. And before 1782 was amended, it did not have that language. And it applied strictly to foreign courts, because essentially the way 1782 was fashioned originally, it was meant to be the statutory provision for the granting of mutual legal assistance among countries. So typically that occurs from one court to the other court. Now, in the U.S., of course, we have what's called the adversary proceeding, meaning that the parties themselves or their lawyers play a much more decisive and active role than in civil law countries. And so we also have the right of the litigant to make requests, so it's not just the courts. But still, the understanding was that 1782 applies only to court proceedings and not to anything that is not a, a state-created judicial body. Now, in 1964, when 1782 was amended, late Professor Hans Smit was the legal advisor of the Congressional Committee that actually crafted the language, and he then later wrote an article about this whole amendment process, and in that article, he said that what Congress understood the tribunal to mean was investigating magistrates, administrative and arbitral tribunals, and quasi-judicial agencies, as well as conventional civil, commercial, criminal, and administrative courts. So it was Professor Smit who basically set off this debate by commenting that that was the intent of Congress. Now, this issue never really came to the fore until 2004, and even then in the Supreme Court case of Intel versus Advanced Micro Devices, it was not really at issue. In that case, the foreign proceeding was a proceeding before the European Commission. It was an antitrust or a competition proceeding. So it had nothing to do with an international arbitral tribunal, really. But in that context, when the Supreme Court clarified the role of the European Commission and found that the Commission also qualified as a foreign or international tribunal, it also went on and commented on Professor Smith's article, and then threw in an aside, which can be read as meaning that international arbitral tribunals, meaning international commercial arbitration type tribunals, are also included. Now, before the Supreme Court issued its decision in Intel, the issue had only come up twice, and in those two cases, these were cases of the Second and Fifth Circuit, the consistent holding was that 1782 at most could apply to governmental arbitral tribunals or arbitral tribunals created by acts of government, although it wasn't clear what those could be. But in those cases, the holding was it certainly did not apply to private arbitral panels. And in those cases, one of the arbitrations was an ICC arbitration, and the other one was a Stockholm Chamber of Commerce arbitration. In both cases, the consent to arbitration, the arbitration agreement, was found in contracts. And so against that background, the Second and the Fifth Circuit found that these were private arbitrations, and therefore no access could be had to Section 1782. Now, after the Supreme Court's Intel decision, the Fifth Circuit continued with its line of jurisprudence, and also the federal district courts in Illinois and South Carolina likewise found that the Supreme Court's decision didn't really change anything, so that henceforth, still discovery in aid of private arbitration could not be had under Section 1782. By the same token, you had courts, and these were the federal district courts in New Jersey and Florida, as well as the Third Circuit, finding that public arbitrations do qualify. And so there we finally have some jurisprudence on what is a public arbitration. And the examples here were that certainly treaty-based arbitration is public, treaty-based arbitration being arbitration in which the arbitration agreement is at least partially found in a treaty, such as a bilateral investment treaty. And this was found in the circumstance of an ancestral arbitration based in London that was based on the UK-Kyrgyz Republic bilateral investment treaty. In the Third Circuit, the question wasn't really decided. There was just a dictum because in that case, the applicant, which was Chevron, is one of the many proceedings in the Chevron versus Ecuador cases, in that case, Chevron relied on both the arbitration, which was a bilateral investment treaty arbitration under ancestral rules, as well as on the Ecuadorian court proceedings, and then the court just didn't really get into the question of whether the arbitration proceedings qualify as a basis for the 1782 application. It just rested its decision on the Ecuadorian court proceedings and said that that was fine. Then in most recently, it was really quite recent this year, a federal district court in Florida found that NAFTA Chapter 11 arbitration also is public arbitration and qualifies. And in that case, what was interesting, it was actually a request for evidence from a third party to prove conduct of the state, in that case Canada. Well, we'll get to the policy aspects of all this in a moment, but I just wanted to point that out now. Now, finally, there are certain courts that have held since 2004 that private arbitrations do qualify for 1782, and they rely on the Supreme Court's decision in Intel on that. And you'll see these are the federal district courts in Delaware, Florida, Georgia, Massachusetts, and Minnesota. And the arbitrations at issue were Vienna Center, an ad hoc arbitration in Israel, ICC arbitration in Germany, a Swiss ad hoc arbitration, and then an arbitration cited in London under the London Maritime Arbitrators Association rules. So what we have here, in effect, is a split among the various judicial districts, and as we will see, in fact, we even have a split among the circuits, because just this year the 11th Circuit came out with a holding that a domestic arbitration before the Guayaquil Chamber of Commerce in Ecuador, and that arbitration was among foreign parties, actually qualified as a basis for a 1782 decision. And so in effect, I mentioned earlier that we had the Fifth Circuit still sticking to the old rule saying that private arbitrations do not qualify. Now, we don't have a real proper circuit split because the Fifth Circuit's decision in that case actually was not published in the Federal Reporter, and therefore does not qualify as a real precedent. And accordingly, we don't really have a real circuit split that would actually enable the Supreme Court to step in. But we do have a de facto circuit split, and I'm pretty certain that within the Fifth Circuit, the next ruling will be the same as the prior ones. And if it does get published, then we will have a real circuit split. So this is something that's really subject to a lot of uncertainty at this point. But at the same time, I can point that out now. If you are in the situation where you are looking at either making such an application or defending against one, it's really important to look at the judicial district in which you are and what the background there is in terms of the jurisprudence and the precedent. It's kind of hard to speak of form shopping in this context because the selection of a district will always depend on where the target is for your discovery request, and you can't really choose that much. But there are cases, and actually there was one of the, two of the cases that I showed here involved the same arbitration. One was in the Fifth Circuit and the other one was in Delaware, and they came out with opposite results. So it's a tricky business. Now, coming to an end, the policy issue that I see, we've talked about the practical issue, but there's a real policy issue here, and that is, in my view, should U.S.-style discovery really become part of international commercial arbitration? Is that something that is contemplated by the parties when they enter into an arbitration agreement? And note, it's not an arbitration cited in the U.S. We're talking about arbitrations outside of the U.S. Between parties that are not U.S. parties, where one of the parties may have links to the U.S. or there may be evidence, or it might even be third parties that are in the U.S. and that have certain evidence that might be relevant. And then the question is, should a party to an arbitration agreement, to an arbitral proceeding, really be allowed to go off and conduct U.S.-style discovery in aid of the arbitration? Obviously, the law here in the U.S. allows for that to the extent that the courts have found that it applies to arbitration. But there is the element also of control by the arbitrators of their own proceedings. Why should the parties not have to go to the arbitrators and ask them for an order and then go maybe get that order and go seek to enforce that order in other countries or in national jurisdictions? Now, this issue was broached a little bit in a recent decision of the Federal District Court here in the District of Columbia, in the application of Caratube, and this was in relation to an ICSID case, Caratube versus Kazakhstan, based on a bilateral investment treaty. And there you had the situation where the arbitral tribunal had actually already dealt with requests for documents, and that whole evidentiary proceeding was actually over, and the applicant, Karatub, applied for an extension of time so that it could go and make this 1782 application. The tribunal did not grant the extension of time. Karatub went ahead and made its application anyway. The tribunal then, upon the complaint of the other party, Kazakhstan, found, well, it didn't really like the fact that you know, the claimant at Karatub went off and did this, but it reserved its position as to whether it would accept or not any documents resulting from this process. Now, the court then, the district court thereafter, when it made its decision, took that into account and said, well, actually the tribunal was not very pleased, although it didn't really stop the party from doing it, but it also wasn't pleased with it. And in the end, it denied the requests applying the discretionary factors that we talked about earlier. Now, I just wanted to point out in this connection, for example, the Ancestral Model Law in Article 27 actually says expressly that approval of the tribunal is needed for any court assistance in taking evidence. Now, the Ancestral Model Law has been enacted in the U.S. only in a handful of states. Notably, it has been enacted in Florida, which is the very one of the states in which the judicial law now is actually the opposite. And the only way to reconcile that is, of course, by taking note of the fact that the enactment of the Ancestral Model Law in Florida is via a state statute, which does not apply to the federal judiciary and its procedures, whereas 1782 is in the Federal Judicial Act. So there again, you've got a difference between federal and state law on this topic. That concludes my presentation, and I'd like to thank you very much indeed for your patience and for listening, and I'll be happy to entertain any questions. Thank you. Yes, please.
So from Section 1782, it seems that the United States is at least partially friendly towards international proceedings. But how likely are other countries to follow this approach and actually order their citizens to produce their requested information? Have you found that there's a similar approach, that they all generally tend to cooperate in proceedings?
I've found there are a couple of interesting articles surveying exactly that question. And there's, of course, one big difference, and that is the point that I made early on, and that is that here in the U.S., it's the private litigant that is the driving force. And that, in you know, most civil law countries, that's not favored very much. You know, if you've got a request for judicial assistance, whether it's emanating from an arbitral proceeding or from a court proceeding, they always want to see some kind of, at least an approval by the court or by the tribunal, because that's just the way the system works in those countries. And so likewise, well, the Ancestral Model Law, which I just had on the screen, is actually implemented in about 60 or so jurisdictions worldwide. And that's, you know, it's implemented in most of the major sort of arbitral centers. And so in those countries, there is the requirement of approval of the arbitral tribunal. So the request can come either from the arbitral tribunal itself or from a party, but then with the approval of the arbitral tribunal. So a court in those countries would want to see that, you know, evidence of that approval before moving forward. But subject to that, yes, I know, for example, in Germany, my home country, there is a statute that says exactly that, that you know, you can get a court order to produce evidence in aid of arbitration with the approval of the arbitral tribunal. And I think it's similar in many other countries. Thank you. Thank you.
Doesn't matter. No. No, it's okay. Oh, it's all right. You can keep it. Okay. There's a little break.
Leave it neutral.
Sure. Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's an honor for me to join ILSP's 30-year celebration and this panel on commercial arbitration, thinking about what trend to address that is relevant these days in connection with commercial arbitration. I thought, well, perhaps address in the treaty-based investment arbitration context, how is the field addressing the public interest? It is already a truism to note that investment arbitration in the last 20 years has expanded considerably. And given this expansion, it is coming to realize that it needs to engage the public interest in various ways. There is no question today, if there was ever a question, perhaps 5, 10, 15 years ago, that investment arbitration, treaty-based arbitration, is qualitatively different from commercial arbitration, international commercial arbitration involving private parties. For one, it involves the state in a sovereign capacity. And second, it usually involves allegations of violations of public international law, bilateral investment treaties and the like. So given these structural differences, we would expect investment arbitration to be based on tenets that are different from commercial arbitration. But I will submit that given that the practitioners, as one academician put it, shuttle back and forth between two regimes, there is still the use of certain commercial arbitration frames to analyze public investment arbitration. And I will today address the implications of three issues. The emergence of a human right to access to information, first. Second, what is the practice of amicus curiae briefs? And third, what is the relevance of non-investment law in investment arbitrations? So jumping right into this list of issues, when we're talking about access to information, we're talking about a new human right. This right has been recognized by the Human Rights Committee that oversees implementation of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights only last year in a general comment that it was issued in connection with Article 19 on freedom of expression. So given that we're dealing with a new right, we can expect that the implications of the normative content of that right, which are far-reaching, are yet to be discerned. Some of the sources of the right, the Human Rights Committee finds support in the jurisprudence of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights that first linked freedom of expression in the American Convention on Human Rights with access to information. Secondly, the European Court of Human Rights, which for decades had resisted making the link between freedom of expression and access to information, recognizing that there is such link and talking about a freestanding right to access to information. These are the sources, generally speaking. What is its content? What are states obliged to do? First of all is the recognition of the principle of maximum disclosure, the idea that the state needs to disclose the information of public interest that it holds. It's a simple formulation, and we can already appreciate how far-reaching that may be. Now, having said this, it is not an absolute right. international human rights law recognizes the possibility of permissible restrictions. It does subject these permissible restrictions to stringent tests, such as provided by law and necessary in a democratic society, among others. So we can see that the implications here are far-reaching and they go beyond investment arbitration. They concern international dispute settlement generally. For those of you interested in the work of the International Court of Justice, for example, the ICJ has a practice of making pleadings available just before a hearing. We can anticipate that in the coming years, somebody will come up and say to the court, well, there is a right of access to information, and we have the right, as citizens of the state participating in contentious proceeding, to know what is going on in these proceedings, to have access to those pleadings. Here we can also see that there is a potential parallel with what the ICJ has done in connection with standards of due process that relate to the court's proceedings. Some of you may be familiar with the advisory opinion of the ICJ recently rendered in connection with the decision of the Administrative Tribunal of the International Labour Organization. Since only states can appear before the court, and since those proceedings pertain to the rights of an individual that had been allegedly mistreated by the tribunal, exercising jurisdiction, the court went ahead and changed certain practices in its procedure so as not to create a situation where the individual would be prejudiced by the exercise of adjudication. So we can already see how due process standards in human rights law are beginning to affect and have an impact on the process followed in international adjudication. So thinking about investment arbitration more specifically, what are some of the implications? Well, first of all, there's the question of access to documents, access to the pleadings of the parties, access to the award rendered by the tribunal. Then there's also the question of access to hearings. The information produced in the hearings that may be organized under that arbitration. It is fair to say that already much progress has been made in this area. There are a number of arbitrations that are proceeding in open doors. Some are being webcast. Some are conducting hearings that are open to the public. That being said, many other arbitrations are proceeding behind closed doors, even though they involve questions of serious public interest, such as allegations of denial of justice and the functioning of the court systems, or the implementation of the right to water and sanitation, or the implementation of the right to health in connection with tobacco control measures. Much more could be said and analyzed from a legal perspective on confidentiality orders and the like, and I make those points in a recent law review article that is available in the ICSID review, which I point to you. I point to you in that direction. So the second point I wanted to address today concerns amicus curiae participation, the participation of the public in the arbitral proceedings. Here we are confronted with issues of a broad nature, such as principles of democratic inclusion, an international order that's equitable, a recasting of sovereignty, a devolution of sovereignty, and a reconfiguration of what the state means. So these are far-reaching concepts that first found in the World Trade Organization the arena where controversy struck. At the World Trade Organization, a number of arguments were presented against amicus curiae participation. For example, that they would flood the gates of the proceedings, or that amicus participations would disadvantage developing countries, or that amicus curiae submissions were alien to civil law traditions, were a common law creation. Eventually, these arguments have been overcome by legal argumentation and policy argumentation and by the practice. There was significant controversy for a number of years, and then the controversy went away when the practice became accepted. That being said, in the investment arbitration context, the the controversy, I believe, remains. ICSID recently reformed its rules of arbitration, as we know, and incorporated a specific provision governing this matter. Now, the interpretation of those rules, I would say, of course, depends on a legal argumentation and reasoning, but in the background, there's that level of comfort that arbitrators and the parties, the contending parties, may have with the kinds of issues that pertain to the public interest that arises in the investment arbitration. A couple examples of a couple recent cases that I have been involved in the Pac Rim arbitration involving El Salvador and a mining company, the amicus curiae brief raised as a jurisdictional issue a point that had not been raised by the parties. Is that within the scope of arbitration as required by the arbitral rules? We would argue it is within the scope because the tribunal has the obligation, the power indeed, to satisfy itself that it has the jurisdiction to hear the case and adjudicate the claims. This is central to the integrity of arbitration. And yet, it poses a tension because the tribunal has not necessarily been briefed on that issue prior, and only the amicus curiae brief exists. So there are issues that arise there. There is also the question of independence. Who can appear before the tribunal? What kind of information should be presented to the tribunal in order to determine independence? This question of independence has generally been read as, well, not controlled by one of the parties, independent financially, so not receiving money, not being a front for one of the contending parties. And yet, in a recent arbitration involving Zimbabwe and land rights and indigenous peoples, there is some language there that seems to suggest that independence also relates to the content of the positions advanced in the amicus curiae submission. I would respectfully submit to you that that interpretation would negate the purpose of this of amicus curiae briefs, because we can anticipate, for example, in the Philip Morris arbitration involving Uruguay, claims involving tobacco control measures, that civil society organizations intending to participate in the proceedings may well have views that are quite antagonistic to the tobacco corporations. That does not make them less independent of the proceedings. So there are a number of issues that arise there. In this Zimbabwe case, one of the interesting issues was whether the international law on the rights of indigenous peoples could be brought in to the arbitration through an amicus curiae submission. The arbitral tribunal concluded that that was beyond the subject matter of the arbitration. So this then takes me to the third point. What is the role of non-investment law in investment arbitration? And I think that the point of departure here must be that it is well settled in international law that international tribunals are not courts of general jurisdiction, unlike domestic courts. They derive their jurisdiction from the instruments that confers jurisdiction by the parties. And so that is limited, that jurisdiction is limited to that instrument and what the terms of that instrument pertain. Now, a number of bilateral investment treaties refer to the treaty and applicable rules of international law. There's been significant debate about what this applicable rules of international law is. It mirrors the amount of ink that has been spent debating the terms of Article 42 of the ICSID Convention, the law of the host state, and international law where applicable. In practice, we're seeing that claimants, defendants, amici are raising human rights issues in the arbitrations. And this has put the investment arbitration field in a bit of a challenge. How does it respond? Now, we're talking about individual tribunals and we're talking about a broader field. I get the impression that some tribunals feel a bit uncomfortable with these kinds of allegations. It's not their comfort zone of where they maneuver most easily. Other tribunals have embraced human rights norms or rationales or jurisprudence in drafting decisions, in approaching the procedure even. I will point out that the distinction between jurisdiction, applicable law, and interpretation is useful when thinking about the role of human rights norms in an investment arbitration. If we think about this typology and the differences here, then we can relate to the fact that arbitral tribunals, not being courts of general jurisdiction, would not have the jurisdiction to entertain causes of action based on violations of human rights law instruments. Now, as a matter of applicable law, however, there would be no bar for an investment arbitral tribunal to incorporate into its analysis arguments based on human rights when brought as a defense by the respondent or in a situation involving a conflict of norms. And in any event, a BID provision, a bilateral investment treaty provision, as an instrument of international law, falls to be interpreted under the terms of the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, which codifies the principle of systemic integration, bringing the normative environment into the interpretation process, so taking into account those other norms that are applicable in the relation between the parties to the BID. Now, this raises some interpretation issues of itself, which I won't get into it, but I will point to a couple examples. The fair and equitable treatment standard, which is, as we know, open textured, it's broad, its meaning is hard to assail or seize. It has been interpreted as linked to the minimum standard of treatment. In that context, developments in human rights law that have impacted on the MST cannot be ignored in any interpretation of the fair and equitable treatment standard. And by the same token, if the fair and equitable treatment standard is applied as an autonomous treaty standard, then the analysis of legitimate expectations and the balancing process that takes place cannot ignore the legitimate expectations of society as much as those of the investors in the protection and the observance of human rights. So those are a couple examples that go to show how the treaty standards, in this case the fair and equitable treatment standard, can benefit in the interpretation process from a human rights-based approach. I believe we're running a bit tight on time, so I will, on this point of the role of non-investment law in investment arbitration, point to one more thing, that it is possible that egregious human rights violations by an investor could be argued to constitute a breach of international public policy, much in the line of what has been an emerging standard of corruption or anti-corruption. And if that is the case, that could constitute a bar to the exercise of jurisdiction. I will leave that at that and only conclude that in this day and age, that there is no question in my mind that investment arbitration implicates issues of public interest. Investment arbitration as a field is grappling with the challenge of incorporating these public interest issues both as a procedural and a substantive matter. And splendid isolation, if the World Trade Organization provides any lessons, is not an option, and normative dialogue is the only way forward. Thank you very much for your attention, and I'll be happy to hear any questions.